And welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, the speaker is Paul Menzel, and he will be speaking on the tobacco policy on the hot seat. So let's listen in on Paul.
I'm Paul Menzel. I teach philosophy at Pacific Lutheran University. Got interested in a number of issues on health policy quite some years ago. I've gotten interested in tobacco policy only. Sorry, you want to put it around the front? Gotten interested in tobacco policy about 5 years ago in relation to one specific question, namely what costs smokers impose on others, monetary costs. And in the last 6 months, I've gotten a little more embroiled in things that are really out of my field. So I'll apologize for being very much an amateur in the state of my research at this point and my thinking, but I've tried to put a few pieces together in terms of a social philosophy of tobacco regulation. And in a nutshell, it's this. This is trying to balance the values of liberty and legitimate intervention in the use of a substance, both to protect others and to protect the person using the substance from what I'll call fooling herself. That will become clear in a minute. The balance of these considerations leads me to some different conclusions than current policy. They lead me to conclude that we should not raise the cigarette tax much at all, at most to $1 a pack. The considerations also lead me to conclude that we should probably have very sharp restrictions on the use of tobacco by adolescents, perhaps a full ban, which implemented seriously would of course mean the removal of all vending machines from public places and their confinement strictly to adult private clubs. Thirdly, we might consider some regulations about smoking in houses with children in the family. But that gets stickier in terms of practical considerations. So I'm not averse to regulation of smoking, though some of the things I'll say may make me sound like a libertarian, that smokers can do anything they want to hurt themselves, and that's their business. Basically, I think the task of public policy is to take account of the value of liberty in this discussion. If because I say that you type me as a libertarian, go ahead, but I can warn you that philosophically, my libertarian friends, if they would consent to that term, think that I'm a heretic for having jumped ship on and supported regulation on a number of these counts. So, four items. First, the perception of risk by smokers. Secondly, costs. Thirdly, costs imposed on others, economic costs. Thirdly, other costs, not economic costs, imposed on others. And fourthly, addiction, and how that shifts some of the arguments. The last is particularly new to me, but also particularly interesting at the current time, because the FDA is considering, Congress has asked the FDA, or FDA is, I'm not sure what the direction of request is, but at any rate, the FDA is considering the whole question of whether or not nicotine is addictive enough to consider the elements that it is linked with, in this case, tobacco, a drug that must be regulated by the FDA. I'll have some comments on that in a minute. This, of course, would be the most revolutionary move of all we've seen in recent public policy discussions of tobacco. First, perception of risk. You can find lots of different studies. Let me just show you one that I think is somewhat credible, though again, this is not my field. The social scientific empirical data is not my field. And I'll cautiously discount some of these figures and then make an observation for public policy. Many people have argued in the following way, that neither prospective smokers nor actual smokers correctly perceive the risk to their own health that smoking constitutes. And therefore, if the society either increases the tax to a point where it's very difficult for people to buy the substance, or if it more extremely were to outright ban it, or if it makes it difficult to get in certain ways, bans advertising, etc., that's no violation of people's liberty, because the liberty of a person is the opportunity to make a choice based on reasonably accurate information. That's only one construal of the notion of the value of liberty, but it's a very plausible one, I think. Now, let's assume that, in fact, liberty is much more valuable when it is attended by relatively accurate information, and that the value of respecting liberty drops as the information the people have on which they act gets grossly distorted. Make that assumption. The conclusion is, if smokers and prospective smokers don't honestly see the risks to their own health in either picking up the habit or continuing it, then society is not violating their liberty in putting certain barriers to their continuing or starting the habit. But look at data like this. This is by a very reputable economist who found that because of the paucity of, I'm sorry about the fact that I made this slide here and we don't have, I discovered in Holden Village, at least I couldn't get this afternoon, a real transparency marker pen. I'm sorry I didn't make this before. But we can make it out here anyhow. Who marshaled some of his own studies under a team, because he didn't find the ones that were done already in the literature to the point. Four categories here. Let's leave this at, move it over here first. First, lifetime risk of lung cancer to the smoker. What is the chance of it? Lifetime mortality risk to the smoker from things other than lung cancer, but including lung cancer also. Lifetime mortality risk to someone, either the smoker or others, everybody combined. That is, you would take the lifetime mortality risk of all the people affected by a given smoker, total up that risk. If it's 1% to 10 people, that would constitute 10%. Add it to the risk to the smoker, which would say 30%, and you get 40% for the risk to everyone, mortality risk for everyone, lifetime. This is not a risk of dying this year. This is a risk of dying sometime. It's a mortality risk, not just a disease risk. And finally, average years of life lost from smoking. What do smokers perceive these percentages to be? Scuzzi found that smokers perceive the risk of lifetime risk of lung cancer to a smoker to be 37%. The public perceives them to be 43%. That's by everyone. And and the actual risk in the literature is 6 to 13% risk of lung cancer. So it's not only the general public, but it's also smokers who overestimate by a factor of 3 to 4 the risk of getting lung cancer. So the argument that we can discourage the use of tobacco because people underestimate the risk of harming their health from it goes down the drain if these figures are even accurate by a factor of 4. Secondly, lifetime mortality risk, not just from lung cancer. 47% is estimated by smokers, by everyone 54%, actual 18 to 36. Scuzzi was very careful there. He took various studies that claim maybe the risk from this factor is this much. We don't know yet. He put those in at the top end. That's why it's 18 to 36. But notice, this is considerably higher than even the top end. Finally, the lifetime mortality risk to someone, just the actual risk is 23 to 46. That's hard to phrase. The reason that was left out of his studies is it's confusing to people. And he said he wanted to do another study to clarify that, but he plugged in the actual numbers there. Notice that this might be relatively correct, but these are the high side numbers. The risk to everyone from somebody smoking, including the smoker, was 46%. Smokers estimate that risk to be 47%. They still don't underestimate. Now, of course, other studies might show that this is 35, on how you ask the question and ask another. Lifetime years of, average years of life lost from smoking. Smokers estimated to be, older smokers estimated to be 7, younger smokers estimated to be 18. There has been a shift in the perception of the risk as we've educated the younger population, both naturally in our culture and specifically in the public schools and in families, about that risk. The estimate by everyone in the population is 11.5, and the actual years of life lost, according to the best studies we have, again, the estimates aren't. These are estimates, the high-end estimate, 7.2. Again, even older smokers do not underestimate that number of life years lost. So, Scusi's conclusion, and unless the empirical data is different, and my conclusion too, would be that inaccurate risk perception does not justify any barriers that the society might want to put on the use of tobacco. Now, one caveat on that. What if we found out, and there is some data to show that, though it's soft data, to show that adolescents, though they accurately estimate, by the way, he's got a separate column, separate study on adolescents, and it shows they're just about as high as this, the estimate by Spoker. And down here, they're actually the highest. Adolescents are the highest. But what about adolescents who are about to start or who have started? What about them? Do they underestimate their risks? No, they're not much different than the rest of the population. But some studies show that there may be a, oh, it won't be me, denial phenomenon. Now, that's tricky to deal with. I mean, if I say the risk is 18%, or, well, the risk is 47%, the number of years likely to be lost if I smoke is 18. If I say that when I'm picking up the habit, but say it won't be me, how should we say that's a case where people are really informed and they make a decision, or what? That's an interesting question. And if in fact we came to a clearer understanding of what that "it won't be me" claim meant in the minds of adolescent smokers, I might be willing to say we should still, for this reason, put great barriers in there picking up the habit.
When I work with the elderly, I'd say 75% of my nursing is for people that have smoke-related diseases. And so we could do it. The quality of life definitely is way down compared to the normal.
That's right. There are other costs than mortality. That's right. We'd have to put in some, there's a lot more complexities here.
They may just lose 7 years, but the quality of life the last 20 years of their life is terrible.
But do smokers tend to underestimate that? The data is... it's not at all clear that they do. In fact, this data would be inclined to conclude that they don't underestimate that. There still may be a denial phenomenon of certain smokers.
This summer, I worked with a group of young people, early teens, all of them heavy smokers. And their philosophy was, well, I'm not sick yet. I mean, it hasn't affected me. I've been smoking for a year, so.
Even though they might say that
There's
a 47% chance that sometime, or sooner or later, I'll die. Yeah. Right. It may also be a discounting phenomenon.
Yeah.
It really will hurt me, but I don't care about things after 60. Now, is that irrational enough for us to say, as a matter of public policy, you don't have the liberty to pick up the habit? Well, there are all kinds of other discountings, irrational discounting of things in the future that people go through, that we allow them the liberty to act on. Why is smoking any different? I don't want to say it isn't any different. I just think it's a very open question. Okay, moving quickly, because there are a lot of different dimensions of this, and I don't want to talk the whole hour by any remote imagining score. Costs.
You don't have estimates of lifestyle reduction or years in the hospital or anything like that?
The morbidity risk, no, is not in this study, and would have to look at the literature a lot more widely of that. There's also, of course, smoking defenders say, the pleasure of smoking. I mean, why do people smoke? Why do people at 55 who could quit not quit? We get to some extent to the addiction question, but many do quit. Many more unquestionably could quit, even if it's very difficult to quit because it is an addictive substance. Why don't they? Part of the reason, not all of the reason, but part of the reason is the pleasures of the habit. If we want to say those count for nothing, then of course the public policy decision takes a certain turn, discussion takes a certain turn, but do we really as a society want to say that those subjective pleasures count for nothing?
I would say that the 55-year-old who would like to quit but doesn't because he enjoys the habit probably can't quit because he is addicted to it. And they probably tried to quit many, many times, but when that nicotine level goes down in the blood, there's real discomfort there.
Let me handle that when we get to the addiction.
Okay.
But it is a very important component for the discussion. Quickly, some things on economic costs. These are the kinds of figures you're likely to see in the newspaper. In my opinion, they're woefully miscalculated. I'll get to that in a moment. This is a 1984 cost study done in 1986, but you hear similar things running up into the $80 billion to $90 billion range in the newspaper this past week. And it's on that basis that the $2 a pack tax on cigarettes is justified, for example, the various items that comprise the cost to others here, the economic cost to others. This does not include the economic cost of the cigarettes themselves, because that's paid by the smokers. These are costs to others.
Has there been an estimate on the cost, especially now that smoking employees have to leave their
yes.
workstation?
Yes.
Go out, the cost to the employer of
yes.
the time
these, the good studies all include that now. All include that now. Let me, however, note that this study and all the figures you see in the newspaper virtually, I have yet to see one that did not go beyond these basic, that did not include the fact that I'm going to mention in a minute, that did, I have yet to see figures in the newspaper that did include the factor I'm going to mention in a minute.
Is the cigarette tax in there or out of there?
It's out of there. It's not in there. So we should have, by those costs from 86, we should have a tax that would, in the aggregate, collect $53.6 billion, because those are the costs imposed on others for by
smokers. $2 wouldn't cover anything like that.
Pretty close to it. Yes. The increase of just 75 cents a pack was estimated to raise $32 billion in the Clinton plan. Well, this is the factor that's being omitted. Some of you have heard me talk on this before and heard me mention this before. But when we're talking about economic costs, if that's what we're talking about, these are very real considerations. That there are benefits of smoking economically to other people. Namely, that a person who dies at 75 instead of living to 85 dies from a smoking-related disease costs 10 years fewer of Social Security payouts. That's a real benefit to others. That person who dies at 75 doesn't incur the other health care costs for unrelated diseases that they would have incurred, undoubtedly, statistically, they would have incurred if they had lived to 85. Those medical costs of caring for the extra years of life of a non-smoker more than balance, or approximately balance. The studies vary within only a very narrow range. The highest estimate by the good economists on this, by the reputable economists publishing in the academic literature, is that at most the medical cost to others of smoking is like $1 billion a year. And some argue that it's actually a saving to others. That's the range, a small saving. That's the range of the debate. Furthermore, it's probably the case that smokers save Medicare money. This study has been invalidated by some subsequent studies, but I put it up here just because of the structure of it. years after quitting, a person quits, what's the effect on Medicare? 10 years after quitting, the effect is Medicare saves $991 because they don't have to, Medicare doesn't spend so much money on smoking-related diseases. But 20 years out, it ends up spending, that is losing, $5 million, spending $5 million more because the person quit, because they lived longer. And 40 years out, if this is for a person quitting at 45, Medicare really kicks in at the 20th year significantly. And at the 30th and 40th year, the savings are considerable. The estimate here is that for every person who quits at 45, Medicare loses $1,495. This is after considering, the extra wages that not that a quitter pays because he or she has fewer absentee days, lives to 65 instead of dying at 62, et cetera.
So when you look at all these figures, we should encourage everyone to smoke.
No, I wouldn't conclude that. If we wanted simply to save money in the Social Security system, yes.
Well, in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, there was a there's been a lot of people say it causes more people to die. The guy quite correctly pointed out, saying smoking does not cause more people to die. It causes more people to
die sooner. Sure.
It doesn't cause more people to die. So you got to watch that argument, too.
Yeah. Well, there are many other studies. I could flip up a number of charts here, but I won't. These are the ones that include fires, foregone contributions, losses in earnings, etc. There have been some economists who I think have done a very exhaustive job on those studies. They conclude, or at least probably the most exhaustive study still taken to be so widely in the literature, concludes this. The basic conclusion from the previous chart was that the cost to others of smoking a pack of cigarettes was 15 cents. If we alter assumptions and on the high side estimate certain other costs on the high side, including the cost of fires and the cost to others from the diseases that others incur from passive smoke, we get a major factor there. And then the estimate is 38 cents for net external cost. I think there's actually some underestimates in that, underestimates in some of that. So let's double it and say that it's 75 cents. The current tax average in most states, state and federal combined, is 42. So we would justify an extra 33 cents of tax, not an extra 75 or a dollar. Washington is putting on an extra 45. And if healthcare reform goes through in Washington, there may be an extra 75. It's the most popular part of any funding of any program. So that we may end up with more than a dollar extra tax, which would put us way over the 75 cent total tax. Now, is that unfair? It seems to me it simply is unfair. Unless you said smokers deserve it. But I guess my question is, well, they might deserve some things, but why do they deserve the burden of paying for health care more than just for their extra expenses that they impose on the health care system? Why is it a smoker's, why does a fairness require a smoker to pay for my health care? I can't get that. I can see why a smoker should pay for his or her health care, extra health care expenses. But in fact, smokers don't have extra health care expenses. They do for the state of Washington when it adopts health care reform because it stops at Social Security. Feds take over then. And the extra expenses, there are extra medical expenses imposed on others under 65, but there are savings after 65, especially after 75, from smoking in terms of cost to others. So when Washington imposes an extra 45 cent tax, it's getting it's ignoring the over 65 component of the total picture. But of course, it would ignore it since that's a federal problem. it doesn't mean that the whole, as a social policy, it's coherent.
Well, responding to your question, why should I as a smoker pay more than my medical costs, so I think, there is some increment. Everyone who pays for public medical costs pays some increment above his the cost of his home.
Yeah, I mean above, yeah, above that increment, yeah, which is what the what I call the excess cigarette tax, the cigarette tax above 75 cent total, which I think could be argued for very persuasively, but above 75 cent total per pack cigarette tax. I think we're getting into very
includes paying for poor people and all that who can't afford paying?
No. We're talking about an extra tax. I mean, a smoker pays all the other taxes through employer contributions, which really come out of generally out of his or her paycheck, and payroll taxes or what other general revenue taxes. The smoker pays all of those, as well as the 75, as well as the per pack tax on cigarettes. And I would argue it's unfair for smokers to have to pay more than 75 cents per pack. Extra tax above and beyond the other taxes that smokers, like other people, are paying for a healthcare system.
Because of the fact that they're out there smoking, though, and the unknowns associated with it, for us to do the research to find out the unknowns to prove to the rest of the populace that it is, in fact, your smoking that has caused us the incremental increases that we shouldn't have to bury in the first place, we should charge you extra to get that proven.
One of the reasons why bumped up that 38 cents to 75 is, I think, there. One is just the benefit of the doubt to critics, and the other is the research component. There are problems, things we need to find out here, which cost money to find out, and smokers ought to pay the cost of finding them out.
Does that 75 include the cost of the smokers who don't die, but just go in the hospital?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. Oh, very much so. I mean, that's the thing that everybody counts, is the cost on others of smoking. Stan?
Another point that I think supports that argument is, at least the studies that I have seen have looked at the looked at alcohol in a similar way, have concluded that alcohol, by comparison, is very undertaxed. That,
yes.
You know, here we have another substance that we acknowledge has a major health risk, and those of us who drink but do not smoke are really not, compared to smokers, paying our share.
The problem without that's absolutely right as an aggregate claim. But the problem with translating that into policy is that it is only excess alcohol use, not alcohol use generally, that causes health problems.
Not only that, it's individualized as opposed to socialized. It doesn't affect other people.
Well, it does. The costs of excessive drinking are significant on other people.
It's very easy to count the number of people killed by overdrinking.
Well, but when you tax alcohol, you're not just taxing those who drink to the point where they are putting costs on others. You're also taxing those who drink to the level where maybe they're benefiting others because it reduces their blood pressure or whatever, the French effect of drinking wine. And
there's another problem that the beer and wine and liquor manufacturers are well distributed around the country.
Sure. I'm ignoring the politics here, and I wouldn't deny for a minute that the political alcohol industry is a more powerful political lobby. But one of the reasons the alcohol lobby, industry lobby, is much more powerful than the tobacco industry lobby is the culture, is what you and I think. Now, by the way, why haven't you heard this line about smoking not imposing anything like $1.50 or $2 a pack costs on others from the tobacco industry? Because if they trumpeted that, it's premised on mortality figures, and so they'd be admitting all those, and so they won't breathe a word of it. They'll just let people like me mouth it. But I've got to be careful that I fill out the pictures so that I'm not in their hip pocket.
This has really scary implications for the healthcare going on now. Here they've got this magic way to pay for it all, and yet it's really going to cost us a whole lot more.
Right. Now, the only thing that made me back down for a minute, or consider backing down from the things I've just pointed out about costs and my feeling that it's unfair to charge smokers more than $75 extra tax per pack cigarette, is 7 cents, excuse me, is somebody said, well, what if politically it just was a fact that the only way we could get health reform passed is with a $2 a pack cigarette tax? Then would you take the devil's bargain here?
Well,
Maybe, sir, Sherry.
Taking the devil's bargain, because in the state of Washington, we have an 8-cent-a-pack tax for water quality.
Yeah, that's the devil's bargain.
8 cents of the cigarette tax in Washington state goes to pay for wastewater treatment plants. You figure that one out.
Smokers don't dirty the water that much. That much more than everybody.
Washington for veterans of World War II pensions to benefit.
Right.
Sure.
Okay.
Still.
Yeah. I beg out of the discussion at that point of the medley of things we've got in the whole tax system. But
what happens when everybody quits smoking?
Oh, yes, they've considered it.
With all the funding, then it's...
Oh, yeah. And in fact, some economists have come out right in the middle of the healthcare reform debate and said, don't raise the tax above $1.23, because $1.23 a pack is precisely the point at which, is the estimated point at which smokers will decrease their use of cigarettes, or prospective smokers will fail to start, to a point where total tax revenue from the cigarette tax will decrease as you raise it to $1.30.
So, PLU will have smoking 101 for those who don't.
No.
Patriotic duty.
Although I have thought of teaching a freshman writing seminar on this tobacco policy topic, but I'm not sure what I want to hear the reports on the conversations at Christmas.
I did hear a newspaper reporter on television saying that we smokers spend our whole life being compulsively working, paying taxes, and smoking, and then we die early, so what do you have to complain about?
That's part of what I was saying. Yes?
Getting back to the unknown issue, most of these were done on American studies. How does it compare with the foreign studies? And particularly right now, both Japan, well, all four of the major competitive countries that compete with the U.S. and are all over the world on products have all instituted new anti-smoking initiatives.
Except Canada, which, yeah.
To an extent that it makes us look pretty pauperish.
Canada reduced its tax from $3 to $2 a pack, which is still way higher than ours. England has a higher tax. Scandinavia has a very high tax. I don't know what Japan is. But at any rate, they have much higher rates of smoking in their population. They see that smoking is a much greater danger to health, even their health ministries do, than we do. But I would say to them that the tax isn't any more justified there than it is here.
Well, Canada reduced it only because of Lake Ontario Mafia that was bringing
Yeah, over. Right. They're pragmatic questions. Okay, let me move on. Let me sort of pass by the costs to others. I do think the non-economic costs to others, the health cost to others imposed by smokers, is the most serious. And the typical example is the family, the children. I see no reason, a way that a smoker can argue that it is violating principles of liberty for the society to prevent him or her from smoking in order to keep smoke out of the lungs of his or her children. I don't think that's violating his or her liberty at all, if we think out the principles of liberty, which include not harming others. And smokers are harming children. The problem is, not all smokers have children in the family. Take the case of just a spouse. Should we say that, well, it was the spouse's choice to marry a smoker? So it's she consented, or he consented, to the cost of health, to his or her health, that he or she is now bearing. I'm not so sure marriage decisions can be appropriately analyzed that way. I have reservations about that, but I do think it would be a little treacherous for the government to say that there are no sort of family privacies there that members of the family really share. But children shouldn't have to share them. Maybe we could have a rule that they could have to smoke. If you have children in the family, you have to smoke on the porch. But obviously, how would we enforce that? Though we might. I mean, it's not so out of the realm of conceivability for us to become a culture in which members of families who smoked would move out to the porch. I mean, some people are doing it already, and maybe it'll get to the point where it could even have legal sanction. We, after all, don't allow parents to beat their children. spank them, yes. But,
pregnant?
Yes?
Well, I place myself as an ex-smoker, but I question your statement that it does happen. So I'm not sure about the statistics we're seeing on second hand smoke. They knew the answer before they started this study, and that's what they came up with.
In some cases, that's probably
it's
true.
It's not a clear fact. There's so many chemicals and other elements that we're getting that it's very difficult to pull out. So I'm not sure about the basis for your...
Yeah, we need better data for sure. I would just, for purposes of discussion, give the smoking critic the benefit of the doubt on all his or her data. Right.
Well, I think Ruth? There's a sample of every bad chemical in the world in cigarette smoke.
Ruth?
If you're going to grant the positive aspect of smoking to pleasure to the smoker, you must detract the advantages of smoking as to the unpleasantness of having to smell and smoke, having to inhale it, having to eat with it around you. Or to smell somebody's dirty cigarette.
Yes, but as a matter of public policy, we let parents do all sorts of things to the environment of their children that make things unpleasant to the children. It's when we cross the line into some distinct harm, not just unpleasantness, that we say the state's justified it, society's justified in regulating, others are justified in shaming, etc. So I'm not so sure that the unpleasantness of cigarette smoke is a justification for either to the children, justification for state regulation of parental smoke.
Why is it that the foreign countries perceive it to be a greater health risk from their studies than we perceive?
Because they got 50% of their population smoking, and we've only got 22 now.
It's just a matter of numbers, not
the biggest. Oh yeah, and heavier smokers, heavier smokers.
Type of tobacco.
Oh,
cigarettes
that too.
Are a lot worse. A lot stronger.
That's not true. We've got more chemicals in our cigarettes.
Okay, anyway, let me move to addiction quickly. This is the most puzzling element of all, I think. At first I thought, well, if a substance is addicting, then you can't use a liberty argument to defend the use of it in the population. Because if it's going, if yes, the decision to smoke may be a free decision, assuming it's informed, assuming there aren't misperceptions of the risk, underperceptions of the risk. Assume that. The decision to take up smoking is the decision of a free and informed individual. But if the person is later going to get addicted, then their liberty isn't being, although it's being preserved at the time they pick up the smoking, it's being destroyed once they get into the smoking. And so, for liberty considerations, wouldn't we be justified in saying, you may not pick up the habit? That would, however, I think, be a very simple, a much too simple argument. First of all, addiction comes in different degrees. And addiction does not mean people cannot quit. Addiction means that the desires are more for the substance are more difficult to dislodge. It means that when you don't fulfill those desires, the frustration or dissatisfaction is especially high. But those are all matters of degree, note. And then addiction, usually in the public's eye, and many, many times actually in fact, gets linked with two other considerations. First of all, that sooner or later there will come circumstances which will make the obtaining of the substance very difficult or impossible. So the person will have to go without, and that will be exceedingly difficult. I said difficult, not just impossible, because suppose it means you have to steal to get the, take the cocaine case. You have to become a felon in order to continue the habit. Obviously there are great a great impact on the person who becomes that, and even though the person had a choice or could get out of it, I think that just is a very major factor in considering whether or not the addiction you're going to pick up if you start using cocaine is something that should be respected out of liberty considerations. A fourth factor is that that we think addiction is bad to get into, is that our interests may change. We may later regret having the habit and find it difficult to get out. Now, in the case, however, where we would become addicted to a substance, where it's highly unlikely that our interests would change, where it's highly unlikely that we will have difficulty getting the substance, then the fact that being addicted means if we don't get the substance, we're going to be extremely frustrated, doesn't have much point, because we're not likely to be frustrated. We're not likely to have to go without. And we're not likely to have to encounter this fact about addiction, that an addictive substance is one in which the desire for the substance is very difficult to dislodge. Imagine, for example, being addicted to chewing gum. Not sugar chewing gum, sugarless chewing gum, which didn't harm your teeth. Well, if you were going to Tanzania for a year, it isn't, you pack a lot of chewing gum in a tiny little box. It's going to be difficult to get in Tanzania, and you'd probably get it there anyhow. It's cheap, etc. I mean, we certainly wouldn't say the fact of addiction alone is justification for banning the substance. I think it's one of the reasons why we don't worry about people getting addicted to morphine in terminal illness situations. Because it's just very... that there's no realistic reason to worry about the difficulty of withdrawing from the substance. And so what if they get addicted? If they want the substance, maybe they should know they're going to get addicted, but it's a minor factor in the situation. Now, one fact about teenagers, to get back to the perception here, there's one study noted by Viscusi, and again, I'm only taking his word at this point about this factor, that showed that teenagers, though they didn't underrepresent the risk to health that smoking posed, did underestimate significantly the risk of addiction. And the risk of addiction is much higher than the risk to health. It's more like 80 or 90%. So if in fact I'm going to pick up something which will become addicted, and the fact that I'm addicted to it will likely have sooner or later real costs to me, independent of its direct health harming effects, of any other direct health harming effects, then maybe decisions to pick up the habit are uninformed and we can put certain barriers in their way. It is for that reason that finally I come back to a very strong proposal to the view that we should regulate smoking very strictly for adolescents. Because there's certain things they don't understand about smoking. They do understand that it kills. They don't understand that it addicts or that addiction matters. But addiction does matter. How do we know that? Because we ask 55-year-olds, do you regret having picked up the habit? And most, not all, by any means all, but many, many say, more than the majority say, yes, I regret having picked up the habit. Only now, the costs of getting out are so high that I'm not going to get out, for those who don't get out, and others do get out. If we could separate nicotine from the health-harming tobacco, I suspect we wouldn't have a problem with nicotine per se. Some have proposed, therefore, that the government vigorously pursue the development of a safe cigarette, that is, a nicotine vehicle, cigarette-like in its use of tobacco flavors, and quick uptake, which is part of the nicotine thrill, nicotine satisfaction, it's not really a thrill, satisfaction, which the nicotine patch doesn't emulate at all. You have to have a different vehicle than you have a nicotine patch. And then maybe nicotine wouldn't be bad at all. Certainly shouldn't be regulated by the FDA. And maybe you could get a lot of smokers off cigarettes if you had such a nicotine vehicle. But has the government been willing to put money into developing such a tool that would really help smokers get off the health-harming combination of tobacco, burning tobacco, and nicotine? Nicotine making it more difficult to get out of that habit when people realize the cost of it. No, they haven't. And I think that's, in fact, rather bad for the government.
But we do subsidize tobacco. We have tobacco subsidies.
But the tobacco companies don't want to develop a safe cigarette.
But we do spend.
Because it would not use much tobacco, if any at all.
It
would use tobacco extracts.
The tobacco subsidy that you mentioned?
Well, we probably we could take some of that. No, yes, the subsidy is included in the calculations put on the board before. I think it's terribly irrational both to tax and subsidize at the same time, as virtually everybody else does. That's a political reality. But back to the addiction question, the upshot is I'm genuinely puzzled, other than for teenagers, about what to say the addiction element does to the public regulation discussion at this point in our history. If we had a nicotine vehicle which amounted to a safe cigarette, whether we called it a cigarette or not, then I would be resolutely opposed to regulating that substance. Because nicotine itself, though somewhat health-harming, is not very health-harming, not remotely as health-harming as tobacco itself. Sorry, I've gone way over, but we've had discussion along the way, so that's my piece.
Including the smokeless tobacco that are coming out now, kids are all going on chews. Well, a lot of them are.
Chew is very harmful in terms of throat and mouth cancer. But again, it's not the nicotine in the chew that's the harmful element, except that nicotine is the addicting element, and what people get addicted to is then a tobacco health-harming substance. If you could separate nicotine from tobacco, I think the arguments for sharp regulation would be much. You should separate the addictive substance from the health-harming substance. The arguments for strong discouraging or banning forms of regulation would sharply diminish. Yes?
The word addiction, picking it up and running with it. I think that the term addiction is being dumped into the same pot as disease. Disease is beyond a person's control. What is beyond his control, he is not responsible for. Only big bad corporations and governments are responsible for the actions of individuals or a disease which they cannot help. Now, sort that out. Or dismiss it.
Well, I think disease varies. Some people are responsible. One can be responsible. There are some diseases for which people are responsible. There are other diseases, many diseases, most diseases, for which they're not responsible.
Diseases are usually the outcome, and addictions are the process of getting there. The issue with the addiction portion that we're getting into right now is the regulatory and the liberty issues that you started with, is that if the addiction issue becomes everything, to give an overall control to it. But right now, what they're looking at is putting liberty limits, which are not liberty limits, by saying, well, maybe we can limit the time at which smokers can smoke, wouldn't say like 2 to 4 in the morning and 8 to 10 at night, and that would be it. But unfortunately, because of the addictive processes to it, they could never enforce it.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I got.
Well, no. The right now, we're getting into the addiction aspects of it, trying to regulate it. That's why the FDA is coming in with the whole thing. They're saying it is addictive, and trying to throw it into a different ballpark. Okay. Before they got to that point, one of the means that they were looking at and trying to regulate through the liberty issue was to say, okay, why don't we just designate certain times when we can allow it, that way you can take your whole pack of cigarettes and be smoking in 2 hours that you're designated.
And then you don't impose smoke on anybody else.
Yeah.
Well, but why not let them smoke for 24 hours a day as long as it's in a room that isn't used by others?
That'd be fine.
Yeah. At any rate, I entirely agree with the proposal to separate the notion of addiction from disease. Addiction is a different concept than the conception of disease. And I think to say that something causes diseases is one reason for in the public discussion hopper, and to say that something is addictive is a different reason. And they don't necessarily run to the same conclusion. Again, I trot out the addiction to morphine in terminal illness cases, or the addiction to chewing gum, if people could get addicted to, if there were some element in gum that would be addictive. I don't think we should worry at all about it.
What is your reaction to the congressional hearings that say the companies have manipulated the addictive?
Oh, I think undoubtedly they have. Sure, it's any a moment's reflection on market economics would lead to the conclusion that it's their interest to up the addiction factor as high as they can.
Therefore, it is a drug.
Well, nicotine per se, I don't think, just because it's addictive, should come under the FDA's jurisdiction. It's only because when nicotine gets linked with a health-harming substance that it legitimately, as an addictive element, can get brought, should be brought under the FDA's jurisdiction. Which then raises the question, is it inevitable that nicotine be linked with the health-harming substance, tobacco? My answer is there's several ways to separate it. One, you can leave the nicotine out of cigarettes, but I mean, cigarette companies have already admitted they take it out and then put it back in, or take most of it out and put it back in. And addiction is a matter of degree. And if the addictive amount of nicotine in cigarettes was very low, even though that would be somewhat addictive, we wouldn't worry about the liberty issues nearly as much, because a somewhat addictive substance still leaves people at liberty, more liberty to get out.
People wouldn't smoke it.
No, but the people that aren't, already addicted would smoke even more, because they have to get that blood level, they have to get that hit of nicotine.
Yes.
So they're going to smoke even more.
That's right. We've got the.
Which is more health hazard, but more tax money.
That's why we also have to develop a nicotine vehicle separate from tobacco, health harming tobacco. Yes, the total picture comes into play. The picture that avoids the argument that the FDA should regulate this substance out of existence comes into play not only when you have nicotine-less or nicotine, very low nicotine cigarettes, but also when you have tobacco-less or virtually tobacco-less in at least the health, the harmful sense of tobacco, nicotine vehicles. But we haven't put any work into developing tobacco-less nicotine vehicles or safe cigarettes.
What are the statistics as to when people start smoking? Most of them start as teenagers.
Yes.
Because, you know, this thing you talked about regulating teen access, you know, really is a very good point, because teens think they've been educated to the dangers of cigarettes, but again, none of this can happen to me.
Right, and if a 30-year-old says that, I say that's their illusion is their responsibility. But when a 17-year-old says that, I don't say that as easily, because there are lots of things that 17-year-olds say that are illusory. Yeah, right. So I think there's a different responsibility component, and that's why it seems entirely sensible that we regulate it at least as strictly as alcohol, and perhaps more strictly, and push the age of use, legal use, up to 21 at least. Mike? In the back row.
Yeah, is it plausible? Do you think it's plausible to come up with, like you said, a nicotine vehicle, especially with how powerful these tobacco companies are and how much money they have behind them to put towards fighting something such
a relatively tobacco-less nicotine vehicle?
Yeah.
Well, if there isn't a market, actually, one of the puzzles is why there isn't some private capital behind that development.
It was enough of a device to help me.
Yeah.
But I wanted to quit when it did.
Yeah.
I tried many times before.
The proposal for the so-called safe cigarette is rather intriguing, but we have to do much more development research on it to see whether we could actually pull it off. But the proposal is that you you heat, not burn, tobacco to the point where you can release the flavors, but not the tars and the other health-harming substances. That's the proposal. And then you combine it with the nicotine for a safe cigarette, though addictive. But that's like the chewing gum example. Then, if we add it there, but we haven't put any money into developing it. Now, free market proponents will say, well, there just isn't a market for it, or private capital would have jumped in to develop it. But in many cases of cultural battle about things, I think government is justified in marshaling the capital to try something, to see whether it pans out. It could, of course, be a boondoggle, but it would seem to me to be worth a little bit of government research development money, but the government hasn't put a dime in.
But why is it worth government money to do this?
Because we want to break the connection between nicotine and health-harming substance.
But why do we want to do that?
So that people could have their nicotine habit, which is without harming themselves.
But why do...
Because on my view, simply having an addictive habit is not itself anything bad. It depends on what the addiction is connected with.
Why should we put public resources into developing something that would satisfy...
To get people out of the addictive connection with a health-harming substance.
But you've already demonstrated that there's no economic... There's no economic downside to
this. Well, this would not be a self-interested government reason. Namely, we the government are going to save money by doing this to cut down on health-harming cigarettes, health-harming tobacco. This would be a humane reason for the government to jump in. And maybe that's the explanation of why the government hasn't done it, because it is not an economic justification in the government's coffers for doing it. That's a good point.
Yeah. Justification.
Excuse me, there's a question in the back row that's been up for quite a while. I'm sorry.
What test is nicotine no health effect? I've often heard, or maybe I've misheard, that there's a connection between nicotine and circulatory problems. That there are health
hazards
of nicotine associated with circulatory problems. Heart attack, there's been studies of persons, women who smoke, both 5 years older, age 40, because of their
deterioration. Right. But if we have good studies that separated the nicotine from the tobacco, very few. The studies that have separated nicotine from tobacco have shown only a very modest diminution of health from nicotine per se. It's probably there. I mean, you can't do certain things that nicotine does to the circulatory system, which are the things that give nicotine users pleasure, without also probably messing up something in the body. But is it of nearly the order that tobacco is in messing up the body? My guess is probably not nearly the order. And if it is, it's more like refined flour, let us say. Or coffee.
It's an unknown.
Right.
And that unknown gets back to the issue of, is it product by itself or its association with other products that we have.
And
nicotine by itself, we know, does increase your metabolism,
and
which
can
cause other complications from normal substances.
And if we need research development money, I'd be the first to defend 2-cent tax, a pack tax on cigarettes to do that, to fund some of this research that could help smokers. Could be, but maybe we need 5, and then that would be just right. I can get pushed quite high on that reason. Cigarette tax. Ruth, I'm sorry.
Your argument for justifying some tax or some limitation on the possibility that tobacco products are addictive would also put us back into the argument that Stan was talking about. The possibility that alcohol is addictive should also mean that perhaps we should tax that to a greater extent.
If in fact alcohol users don't pay their own freight in terms of the cost they impose on people. And in fact, the studies show that alcohol is quite different than cigarettes because excess alcohol users, again, we got to distinguish, but how would we in a tax? But excess alcohol users, the harm that they impose on others starts earlier than the harm that smokers impose on others. And it runs its course longer. And smokers don't save Social Security. Heavy drinkers don't save Social Security much money because they don't. They do die early, but not as early as smokers do, relative to non-smokers and non-excessive alcohol users.
But also the innocent bystanders are much more affected by alcohol use than by the Very few people are run down and killed in the street because somebody's been smoking a cigarette.
Although we shouldn't underestimate the harm to others when a smoker dies at 75 in a happy retirement family situation in which the spouse is, experiences a very significant loss by that. But we're prone at that point to say that's family matters. Anyway. Okay, we are an hour, and I promise to, we can talk about this informally, but end at this point.